Hey, guys.
Well, that was louder than I meant it to be. Hey, guys. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Tariq Ralph. You may have heard of him. It's very likely if you have heard of him that you have only just recently heard of him. Like me. I knew about this site for a minute and then I completely forgot about it. I better put them, they have an RSS feed here? Let's see. It's AtomicReporters.com. I remember when this thing came out. Well, I'm gonna bookmark them here. And, but anyway, yeah, man, so, this guy, Tariq Ralph, he's a big something or other, I guess. I'll have his, bio. Here it is. Director of the Board of Atomic Reporters. Director of the Disarmament, Arms Control, and Non-Proliferation Program at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. SIPRI. Former Head of Verification and Security Policy Coordination. Office reporting to the Director General, International Atomic Energy Agency. Mm-hmm. And, yes, we are going to be talking about Parchin samples. Ooh, those Parchin samples. And we're also going to be talking about, is it okay if I go ahead and ruin it for you? Well, if you want the suspense, then put your fingers in your ears for a second. Tariq is casting severe doubt on an AP story. And in fact, even the basis of an AP story. Of course, it was George John put out this stuff about, oh, Iran gets to inspect all their own facilities for the IAEA, which, according to the right-wingers, was going to undermine the whole dang deal. And then they started editing the article and then re-editing it back again. And then they finally published the text of a draft agreement between the IAEA and Iran. And supposedly, according to George John, administration officials said that the draft that he showed them did not differ substantially from the final draft agreement. And this is a very narrow, minor, or not minor necessarily, but yeah, it is minor, but it's a side arrangement. It's part of the implementation of the larger deal. And Ralph is casting doubt on the authenticity of the document at all. The text of the draft agreement. He's saying, well, that's funny because I'm a IAEA mucky muck and I'm used to seeing documents like this and this doesn't look like one. And here are all the things that are wrong with it. Many, many things. In my personal view, this is not an authentic document. And you know what? I wish I had taken my time last night. I kind of feel like an idiot. You know when somebody says something smart and you go, oh, why didn't I think of that? Or invent something or something, you know? I wish I'd read this carefully. Paragraph 2. The Islamic State of Iran agrees, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, sure. That's what they call themselves, huh? Yeah, no. You have them confused with their enemies. First clue, this came from Israel. They would have you confused about the Islamic State and the Islamic Republic, which are, of course, fighting right now, killing each other right now in Fallujah and Ramadi. Anyway, we're going to learn all about, so what is this deal? And do the Iranians really get to take their own samples and what it all means? With Tariq Ralph here in just a little while. And we got Gage working on trying to get Doug Bandow and also trying to get this lady that wrote this great thing for Truth Dig about the war in Yemen. Oops, I forgot to turn off the air conditioner. Oh, man, that's loud. She wrote this great thing about the horrible war in Yemen and the fact that it's just being widely ignored. Thoroughly ignored. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. And I don't want to ignore it. I mean, I'm trying to do my best to cover it. There's hardly anybody who's covering it. I think I angered Matthew Akins. I tried to get him back on the show because, see, originally he just wrote a like a blog entry at Rolling Stone, and I interviewed him about the blog entry. But then he came out with this 4,000-word giant thing about the war, so I wanted to interview him about that. And he was like, man, I just did your show about Yemen. And I'm like, yeah, but now you have this whole giant new article that I've read and could ask you about that. And then, yeah, no. Okay, well, who the hell else am I going to interview about Yemen? She's right. Everybody's ignoring it, and it's huge and important. All right. And now, by the way, if you're listening to the show yesterday, at the very end of the show, I was too slow on the draw to play this great soundbite of Dick Cheney complaining about the sanctions in the 1990s. And now I'm hoping that it's long enough to cover me running down the hall to turn off the air conditioner. So now hear Dick Cheney when he was the CEO of Halliburton complaining about Iran sanctions. And you know what? I know that this is not long enough. Oh, well. There will be just a little bit of dead air probably on the other end of it, too.
We find ourselves these days, American firms, cut out of the action in terms of anything that develops with respect to Iran. Unfortunately, as has been pointed out repeatedly in recent weeks, our government has become sanctions happy.
Oh, there you go. I made it back in time. Yeah, unfortunately, we're very sanctions happy now. Great clip. I didn't even know that clip existed for years. I had read the quote repeatedly, and then now I don't remember where I got it anymore, but finally, I stumbled upon the video of him. It was a news site. It wasn't, a collector. It was a news site from back then, I think. And he's in Australia. The highest treason. Standing on foreign soil, criticizing your own government, and saying, come on, Iranians are people too. We want to do business with them. What the hell is this? Isn't that great? What a great question. Glad I had a chance to play it for you and get rid of that background noise, too. All right. Now, the reason I want to have Bandow on, is because of Korea. So somebody in the North shot a bottle rocket over the DMZ. So then the South shelled the crap out of them. Well, I don't know. Maybe not the whole crap, but, bombed the something. And the North called alert, said, Army, prepare for battle. And that's the last I heard. Now, I'm the first to tell you, happy to tell you. You can even watch a speech that I give where this is the first thing I say, which is, yeah, the North Koreans say, talk tough all the time. Say tough things all the time. They don't really mean it, not that much. And so if TV says, oh, my God, be afraid of North Korea, you should look at them skeptically rather than going ahead and being afraid on their orders, because they do talk a lot and bomb very little. That could change. It absolutely could change. In fact, who was it that wrote the great piece for The Week, which is a conservative magazine, about getting out of Korea? Here the South Koreans, and this is something that Doug Bandow has been saying for a long time, the South Koreans are now adopting this expansive posture, taking on weapons and strategies for being a regional power, all while letting their defense from the North go lacking and wanting. But don't worry, the Americans will do it for us. And so, forget that. Defend your own stupid country. What the hell are we doing over there? And it's not even, any kind of dissident opinion or whatever. It's the official policy that our soldiers are there just to be a tripwire. Our soldiers are there so that if there is a war, they will be killed. And the rest of us will automatically be involved. And our troops will come from all over the region to go and fight. But why? Why shouldn't the South take care of their own problems? And of course, the real reason is because the Americans want to prevent reunification. That's why. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. So I'm sitting here reading along to Fox and Friends or whatever it is. It's the same thing, but later in the day. And they got John McCain's daughter up there. And right at the part where I'm reading along the closed caption, she's saying, "Look, you don't have to be an expert about any of this to know how crazy this deal is. We give Iran $150 million, and then we ask them if we can please, and then they won't let us inspect their nuclear areas." Maybe you do need to be an expert. John McCain's daughter. Because, of course, all nuclear facilities in Iran will be under permanent 24-hour inspection and safeguarding. All of them. That's not what's in question. What's in question is Parchin, which is never a nuclear facility, which doesn't have any nuclear material, never did. That whole story is a ridiculous lie, and it's been debunked for years and years. And whatever, we're about to learn from the real expert from the IAEA here on the show about the sampling and whatever and how they'll eventually finish disproving it. But, she doesn't even have her talking points right at all. I mean, maybe the closed caption lady messed up too, or man, messed up too. Maybe she did say billion, but the closed captioning got it wrong. But yeah, the talking point is in the billions, not millions. And we're not paying them anything. It's their money that the U.S. government stole and that other governments stole at the U.S. government's behest being returned to them. See, so that's not a welfare payment out of the Treasury. It's their money is being returned and the sanctions are being lifted. And in response, the Iranians that already have a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, whose nuclear sites are all already inspected, where all of their uranium has already a million times over been verified to have not been diverted from its civilian purposes, is now going to have expanded inspections far beyond that. Now they're going to have permanent inspections at their mines, at all of their conversion facilities, at their centrifuge factories where there's no nuclear material whatsoever. And they're going to be scaling back their nuclear program to significant degrees, blocking even a possible path to a nuke by uranium or plutonium means. Their reactors will not produce weapons-grade plutonium as waste. Their Fordo enrichment facility, where they had been enriching up to 20% for their medical isotope reactor, 20% uranium-235 for their medical isotope reactor, is being will be shut down and will not even have nuclear materials anywhere at it. It will be safeguarded anyway, inspected and safeguarded anyway. But will not even deal with nuclear materials at all. And at Natanz, they're going from 20,000 down to 5,000 centrifuge. But anyway, that's because I don't learn what I need to know about the nuclear deal by watching John McCain's daughter try to stumble through on Fox News. We're going to pay them $150 million and they're still not going to even let us inspect their nuclear areas, huh? And yeah, I don't know, man. I saw one time Bill Moyers, the Democrat, say, one thing that's changed in my lifetime is the delusional are no longer marginal. You know, politically delusional. And yeah, no, I'm not so sure that it's ever true that the people in charge weren't a bunch of freaking lunatics. But I guess I do remember a time where they seemed like they were more informed, at least, as dishonest as they all were. And yet, maybe that's just because I was a kid, you know? I didn't know as much as them about some things. But anyway, I was talking on the phone with Sheldon Richman today, and he was saying, hey, man, what's this with the EMP, Ted Cruz and the EMP? It's mentioned in Chomsky's article today. We're running on antiwar.com, Ted Cruz and the EMP. Chomsky actually brings it up as just self-refuting stupidity. He doesn't even go into it. He's just like, they say Ted Cruz is one of the cerebral ones. He's the guy saying we're all going to die from an EMP. And then he just leaves it and moves on from there, taking for granted that his entire audience to a man is smarter than Ted Cruz and knows better than that. But I'll paraphrase the great nuclear expert Gordon Prather, my friend, nuclear physicist Gordon Prather, who actually used to make H-bombs for the government and knows everything about this. And he says if an atom bomb, an A-bomb, fission bomb, uranium or plutonium fission bomb, is close enough to you to turn out your lights, electricity is the least of your problems, okay, because you've just been turned to dust. Atom bombs don't turn out lights. The only kind of nuclear weapon that creates an electromagnetic pulse is a hydrogen bomb, and not just a hydrogen bomb, but a boosted, radiation-enhanced, high levels, tens of megatons, humongous hydrogen bomb, the kind that our government mostly doesn't use. Our government uses H-bombs so they can miniaturize them and fit a bunch of them on one missile, and then they still go off only, we hope, everybody who's Catholic listening, do the sign of the cross, please. We hope would only still go off at tens of kilotons, not megatons. And so a boosted, radiation-enhanced thermonuclear weapon detonated at just the right atmosphere, just the right level above the atmosphere, above the ionosphere, does create a polarization in the ionosphere that creates an electromagnetic pulse that can short-circuit some things. And yet, they've known about this since the 1950s. And certainly all of our government military circuits, it's all in the contract. Everything has to be up to EMP spec as far as military stuff goes. And whatever other civilian electronics, would ever be short-circuited by an EMP that could, again, only be done or could never be done by Iran, could only be done by Russia or Britain or Israel or maybe China, although I don't even think China. Maybe the Chinese or the Russians could do it, or the American government itself. But the Iranians, no one is even pretending that they could make H-bombs or that they could deliver them above North America. To believe in Ted Cruz's nonsense, you got to believe in just either magic or just, you know, make up stuff. Vladimir Putin hands them ready to go H-bombs. And again, he doesn't hand them an H-bomb that they could use to just nuke New York or D.C. No, he gives them basically a neutron bomb, an enhanced radiation device, not to hit a city with, but to set off in outer space in order to shut off our electronics. And then he's going to shoot it from a barge that he somehow floats, the Ayatollah, that he somehow floats across the Atlantic to our East Coast without getting sunk by America's Navy. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, Click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today, and maybe our only guest on the show today, is Tariq Roof Rauf. See, I screwed it up. I knew I was going to. Our first guest on the show today is Tariq Rauf. He is a director on the board of Atomic Reporters. That's at atomicreporters.com. He is the director of the Disarmament, Arms Control, and Nonproliferation Program at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. That's SIPRI, SIPRI.org. We've talked in the past couple of days about articles there by Robert Kelly, SIPRI.org. And former head of Verification and Security Policy Coordination Office, reporting to the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Wow. All right. Welcome to the show. Tariq, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate you joining us on the show today. My friend Yosef Butt, the nuclear physicist, has been sending along your articles over the last few days here, writing about the Iran nuclear deal. I'm trying to keep up. So, obviously, all the big news is about this report in the Associated Press by George John, saying that there's this unprecedented form of a what they're calling a side deal with the IAEA, part of the implementation of the nuclear deal with Iran would be the inspection of this nuclear, military site, Parchin. And according to the AP story, Iran is going to be allowed to inspect themselves. So if you could, please, sir, I guess to start, give us your best rundown of that article, the major assertions in it, and then the development since then, and then we can get into, I guess this will, you know, if you could end the answer with the part where we get to how last night they released what they said was the document that the report was originally based on.
Yes. So as you know, on the 14th of July in Vienna, the six major powers, including the U.S. and Iran, signed this joint comprehensive plan of action on resolving the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, under which Iran would reduce its uranium enrichment capability and so on. But a side agreement to this is a roadmap that was agreed simultaneously between the International Atomic Energy Agency and Iran to resolve two other issues. So one is the issue about what is called possible military dimensions to Iran's nuclear program. And these are allegations emanating from about 2005 onward that Iran had been engaged in activities related to developing a nuclear weapon. And related to that is a military industrial facility in Iran called Parchin. This is a very large site, over some 50 square kilometers, where they make all kinds of military equipment. And the allegation is that there is a big steel chamber there, much like a big tanker truck, the tank part of the tanker truck. And inside that metal chamber, Iran might have carried out experiments to test the trigger of a nuclear weapon. So these are two areas that need to be clarified, and the roadmap has two separate arrangements that have not yet been made public. And so a lot of the discussion, particularly among the opponents of the Obama administration on this Vienna agreement, is to find out what is in this in these two arrangements. And what George Yan of the Associated Press reported the other day is that somebody in Vienna showed him a copy of the separate arrangement regarding verification in Parchin. And he was not given a copy to take away with him, so he had to sort of write the contents of that document, and which is what he published. So one of my questions is, in this day and age, everyone, particularly every journalist, has a cell phone. Why didn't he not just take a picture of this instead of trying to copy it by hand? Second, there are many problems in terms of the standard language that the IAEA uses, the technical items about verification and so on that all, you know, smell like a stinky rat in there, which is why I personally believe that this document that Georgian was given is not really an authentic document.
All right. Now, yeah, it's true. My best knowledge anyway, that they never did publish a picture of it. They only published copied text, you know, typed out text as an AP story that they put out last night that was republished everywhere. Nothing about a photograph there. But then, you know, I was actually embarrassed that it took, I just had glanced over the thing so briefly last night, I didn't even notice. And I was embarrassed that I had to read your note for it to be pointed out to me that Iran is titled the Islamic State of Iran in this document. I mean, that even sounds like the kind of error that, you know, is too stupid for Mossad. I mean, where did this thing even come from?
Well, you know, if you're Georgian and you're under pressure to copy this document, and, you know, there is a lot of news about IS, Islamic State, so he may have made an innocent mistake.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah. No, that's a plausible explanation,
maybe.
That's why
I was wondering, you know, that it's strange that why George didn't take a picture of it on his cell phone. And but this is usually what happens in these cloak and dagger affairs where somebody from some government or intelligence agency comes up to a journalist and says, well, here is a copy of some document, but, you know, I can't show you everything, the markings on it and so on, because it will reveal where I got it from. So this is the usual subterfuge that is used in the IAEA. And when I was there, we are well aware of this on the forgeries that were given to the IAEA, particularly relating to Iraq. And so the methodology for those forgeries and what purports to be this document that Georgian published, that you can see many similarities in the methodology there.
Mm-hmm. And now, okay, so starting out, the thing about the Islamic State, I could see how that would just be, you know, a slip. But you have, you know, quite a few more notes that you've taken on what's purported to be, at least, you know, his notes of the document he saw. But it looks like, you know, a lot of this stuff couldn't be chalked up to John's errors, or Jan, however you say it, to the AP reporter's errors. He didn't, you know, shorthand it so much that he's using all these terms that, as you say, the IAEA would not use in this context.
Yes, I know George Jan very well. He's a good reporter. I have a lot of respect for him, and he's not a stupid person. He wouldn't, you know, damage his credibility by transcribing sloppily. So I believe he transcribed as faithfully as he could, given the time he was given to copy this document. But this basically shows an amateurish effort to try and come up with this type of document. Most of the language is not language that the IAEA uses in its official documents. IAEA uses very precise terminology, and it has been doing this for 60 years, and there has been no deviation. And then more worrisome are the two key areas about the way in which inspections would be carried out at Parchin. And I find it practically unbelievable that the IAEA would have accepted those two methodologies. One is that Iran itself...
Actually, hold it right there. We're almost at this break, and I want to get back to and make sure you have plenty of time to talk about the methodologies that that this document purports to describe when we get back. But if you could you just give us one or two examples real quick of the language where it just doesn't seem right as we got to this break?
Well, they talk about a technical sort of a meeting, and the IAEA doesn't do technical meetings. It does expert meetings, topical meetings, and so on. The name of the Iranian official who is signing it is practically unknown. IAEA never signed such documents with anyone other than the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
All right. Well, we'll have to stop it right there. When we get back, we'll talk more about that and the methodologies and the rest of the doubt. And then we'll talk about, what's probably going to really be the case when it comes to inspecting Parchin 2. One sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Tariq Rauf, formerly with the International Atomic Energy Agency, writing at atomicreporters.com. And we're talking about George John's big AP story saying Iran gets to investigate themselves. Basically, they get to provide all their own samples. And after his article came under fire, the AP released what is purported to be a draft agreement, which they say they have administration officials confirming that it's not much different in practice or in the import of it than the final agreement. That's what they claim. But then Tariq has taken a look at this document and just says, well, geez, this has not credible written all over it. Such major mistakes here. Terminology that IAEA would not use in a document like this. But then, much more importantly, as you were about to say there before the break, Tariq, it describes processes for the taking of samples and the investigation of this supposed suspected nuclear site, Parchin, that are just not believable to you. And I think the other side of that is what the war party is saying is that, oh, my God, look at this deal that the IAEA wouldn't cut with anyone else. But apparently the Americans are willing to, you know, Kerry and Obama are willing to let the Iranians get away with bloody murder here.
Well, there are some technical problems with some paragraphs in this agreement, particularly paragraphs 3, 4, and 5. So in one of these paragraphs, it says that Iran will give to the IAEA environmental samples taken from one of the buildings at Parchin, where there is this big chamber where apparently explosive tests were carried out by Iran prior to 2003. Normally, the IAEA does its environmental sampling itself. By environmental sampling, we mean you take small pieces of swabs or a piece of cloth, so to speak, of about 4 inches by 4 inches, and you pick up dust samples from the walls, the equipment, the machinery, cracks in the floor. And if nuclear material was used in that location, these swabs will pick up nanogram, microgram particles of uranium. These swabs are then put inside a clear plastic bag, much like the one we see at airports when we go through security. Each swipe sampling kit has 6 of these patches, and they then go to Vienna for analysis. And in Vienna, much like how the International Olympic Committee, when they take samples of blood and urine from athletes, they anonymize them, and 2 samples are sent to independent laboratories for analysis, and then one sample is analyzed by the IAEA itself in Vienna. And normally samples from Iran are sent, one set of samples are sent to the United States, to the AFTAC laboratory outside of Washington, which is one of the world's most sophisticated laboratories to detect the presence of uranium and plutonium, which are the 2 nuclear materials useful for nuclear weapons. So I find it quite unprecedented for the agency to agree that the Iranians themselves would take the samples out of sight of the IAEA. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying it's so unprecedented that it's implausible to you?
It is implausible the way it's written, but it could be as an unprecedented, but as a concession to Iran, if in the presence of the IAEA inspectors, where the IAEA inspectors could clearly see, and they could give the Iranians the IAEA swipe sampling kit and then tell them swipe this part of the wall or this part of this machine and then give the swipe back to me to put in the plastic bag. That is one thing, but this is not how it is written here. And so that makes it quite suspicious. And for the IAEA, it does inspections in 156 countries. So if it makes a special deal for Iran, tomorrow some other country will say, well, I'd like a similar deal as well, please. Thank you. So for those reasons and to maintain the integrity of the credibility of the IAEA's verification system, I personally would find it very difficult to believe that the IAEA would have agreed to such a methodology. From Iran's point of view, they would be trying to make sure that an IAEA inspector doesn't bring in a uranium or plutonium particle on their clothing coming from some other country where they might have gone to a nuclear facility and their clothing might have picked up these particles and then accidentally transport them to Parchin. So that's a genuine fear on the part of the Iranians. And that is why one could see it may be plausible that in the presence of the IAEA, using IAEA equipment, under IAEA direction, the Iranian technician could swipe the wall. Mm-hmm. But then later on, it uses language which is very strange, because I've been involved in the drafting of a lot of IAEA technical documents. It is non-standard language. And IAEA lawyers use a very precise way of referring to technical activities, and the wording here is not that.
Right.
And so some of these are pretty obvious mistakes that somebody trying to cook up a document who could do a little bit of research on Google might write a document like this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, one small point here is that Yosef Butt, who I mentioned previously, the nuclear physicist, has an article at Huffington Post today, or came out last night, about what happened in Syria, where one of the swipes was put in the pocket of an IAEA inspector. It was kind of a rogue swipe that they didn't have companion comparison swipes for all the other analysis. And that was the one that happened to show the uranium on it. So he was showing that. And that, you know, widely verified fact there, and was showing that as a reason, like you were just referring to, why the Iranians might want to do it. But I want to get back to what you're saying here is it is inconceivable to you that the IAEA would agree to a deal where the Iranians take the swipes, but that the IAEA aren't right there in the room within the line of sight holding the Ziploc bag, et cetera, et cetera. And that because this article claims that, this article claims basically what John claims it claims, that Iran gets to inspect themselves, that it just, you're saying this document just couldn't be even a legitimate document, must be a forgery.
Yes, the IAEA wouldn't agree whether IAEA shows up and they say, okay, here I'll swap. The Iranian disappears into a room, comes back 5 minutes later and said, okay, here I swap the inside of the room. So that is implausible. But doing it in the presence, as you pointed out, within the direct line of sight, that one could, it's unprecedented, but one could accept in the current circumstances as a very unique situation. Mm. Then there's also a very bizarre paragraph, which is paragraph 5, that has a courtesy by Iran. The IAEA Director General and the Deputy Director General for Verification would be given a public visit to Iran. I mean, this type of paragraph doesn't belong in a technical agreement. The IAEA Director General has been to Iran several times before, and he doesn't need this type of throwaway text. And it doesn't say what this public visit is for. So again, this is sort of a red herring that sticks out like a sore thumb to mix metaphors. And then it talks about a technical roundtable. Normally, the IAEA language is a technical meeting, a topical meeting, a dialogue forum, an experts meeting. A technical roundtable is, again, not a standard IAEA language. And then one of the people who is signing the supposedly the, his title is also mixed up. It's not entirely incorrect, but it is also not fully correct. So this is a mistake that somebody can easily make when they're trying to cook up a document that is not genuine.
Oh, very interesting. So you're saying not just, as you mentioned previously, before we went out to the break there in the first segment, about the Iranian signatory is wrong, but they even slightly fouled up the title of the IAEA signatory as well.
That's right, yes.
All right.
I mean, this is short form that one could use in a newspaper because you know you want to save words, but in a legal document you use the correct title.
Right.
So and when now, President Obama signs something, it will say the President of the United States of America. I just wouldn't say Barack Obama, U.S. President. So this is that type of a mistake.
Right. Now, in your comment at the bottom, you compare this to the Niger letter. And as you mentioned here, you used to work on the case of Iraq. And I wonder when Mohammed al-Baradei testified to the United Nations that he and his staff debunked the Niger uranium forgeries in 30 minutes using Google. Was he talking about you? Were you the one who debunked the Niger uranium forgery?
No, it was one of my technical colleagues who came from a country, one of the nuclear weapon states. He was a colleague from France who did that. He was the person, not me.
All right. But you were all right there working on the same project at the time, investigating Saddam's
supposed
nuclear program?
Yeah, we were all part of the same team.
Very interesting. And so then, if we're talking, you know, the early part of 2003, then, you know, right before the war broke out, the entire consensus inside IAEA was that there was no nuclear, nothing inside Iraq at that time?
That's correct, and this is what the Director General al-Baradei said on the floor of the Security Council after the presentation by Secretary Colin Powell, who talked about all this fudged, which we found out later, intelligence information. And al-Baradei said that the IAEA had no evidence of the regeneration of a nuclear weapon program in Iraq. He used pretty much those precise words.
Right.
The Bush
yeah.
administration dismissed that, and we all know, you know, all the cooked-up stuff that came out later. And they found nothing after the overthrow of Saddam.
Right. Now, sorry for that diversion, but I couldn't help with the experience that you have there, but to ask that. But I want to ask you one more thing about Parchin, if it's okay, and I'm sorry because I'm actually already keeping you over time. Is it all right if I ask you one more thing?
Yes, certainly.
What do you make of Robert Kelly's analysis of the accusations about Parchin? If I read him right, he doesn't seem to think that there even ever was an explosives chamber there. Gareth Porter has reported that Dan Alenko, the former Soviet nuclear physicist, was not even a nuclear physicist, and his expertise was nanodiamonds, not fission at all. And I just wonder what's your opinion of all that?
Well, first of all, Robert Kelly is a very qualified person. He has worked at the Los Alamos Laboratory in the U.S., also at the Livermore Laboratory in California. He worked on nuclear intelligence for the Los Alamos Laboratory. He worked for the remote sensing department of the U.S. Department of Energy. And so he's a person who knows what he's talking about, who has actually seen and touched nuclear material going into nuclear weapons and knows what nuclear weapons are compared to many others who can talk about nuclear weapons, but they have never seen or worked with nuclear weapons. And so I have a lot of confidence in Bob Kelly's interpretations and assessments. And so Bob has claimed that, first of all, the chamber, he questions the existence of the chamber the way it has been described. And second, he says that even if it was there, the way it's been set up, it couldn't have been used for the types of tests for developing triggers for nuclear weapons as the accusations have it.
Mm-hmm.
And normally when they test for triggers, you do that in the open. And the people are in the bunker, and then you put this protective wall so that the explosive debris, you know, is collected within a certain area. Whereas for nanodiamonds, that's what you need. You need the explosion inside the chamber because you want to collect the diamonds. Whereas if you did the explosion in the open air, the so-called diamonds would be scattered all over the place and you'd have to go pick them off the ground. But whereas when they're in the chamber, they're all inside.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives more credibility, as Bob Kelly points out, to the theory that this chamber if it exists, is really for nanodiamonds, and which was the expertise of this Russian scientist, Danilenko, who's already published a book on this, and he's sort of well-published on that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what Gordon Prather, who's the former chief scientist of the Army and formerly at Lawrence Livermore and Sandia National Laboratories, former maker of H-bombs himself, that was what he said, too, is you test these things outside in the open. But that raises one more question, which is Marivan and the accusations that they were doing explosives testing like this out in the open out there at Marivan, which I think is in western Iran. And I believe my understanding is that the Iranians had invited the IAEA to come on out then, but the IAEA had declined their invitation. Can you shed any light on that?
Yes. So when the Director General issued his report in November 2011, which has an annex which describes these roughly 12 areas of so-called possible military dimensions, there was an entry in there that in addition to Parchin, another location where Iran was accused to carry out nuclear weapon-related development activities is a place called Marivan. And when the Iranians have offered the IAEA twice to visit Marivan, and the IAEA has said that they prefer to visit Parchin. Parchin is the priority place that they would like to go, and they have dismissed Iranian invitations to go to Marivan. And IAEA has not provided a technical explanation as to why Marivan is no longer a site of interest to them. It is possible that they have figured out that the information on Marivan was not authentic, and therefore they have dropped it, but they don't want to publicly admit that. Mm-hmm. But that's my speculation.
Right. And I know it's just speculation, but the counterfactual there, if they really thought that there was something going on out there to find, would it be a priority necessarily? Or they really just have to take these things in order and Parchin first because David Albright's always harping about it or something?
Well, no, there is no logical sequence. So if Marivan became available to them, IAEA should go to Marivan, collect whatever information they need there. And also, as you mentioned, the counterfactual, if the Iranians are inviting the IAEA to Marivan, they are pretty confident that there is nothing there that would incriminate them.
Yeah, seemingly.
Just as when the IAEA did visit Parchin twice before, IAEA did not find any signs of nuclear material, which is what the IAEA is looking for. The IAEA's authority is to look for nuclear material. It's not concerned with exploding bridge wire or conventional explosives or ballistic missiles. That is not the mandate of the IAEA.
Right. All right. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your time on the show, and thank you for your great reporting on this issue, Tariq.
You're very welcome.
All right, y'all, that is Tariq Rauf, and he is director on the board of Atomic Reporters. That's atomicreporters.com. And he is the director of the Disarmament, Arms Control, and Nonproliferation Program at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. That's SIPRI.org. And he is the former head of Verification and Security Policy Coordination, office reporting to the Director General of the IAEA. We'll be right back after this.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commodity discs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Okay, one of those made me laugh. I gotta admit. All right. Hey, so that was cool, man. And I kept him through the top of the hour break there almost all the way to, you know, just a minute ago. So I asked him about Robert Kelly debunking the Parchin. He says, of course, hey, Robert Kelly's the man, man. Take him seriously. And then I asked him about a couple other things there. You're going to like hearing it. The archive will be up at scottwarden.org some other time. AtomicReporters.com. Boy, do I need to keep an eye on this guy and his buddies here. Atomic Reporters. You are now being added to my bookmarks toolbar. You know, I never used to use a bookmarks toolbar, and then I realized that if I got the Roomy toolbar, then I could have all of my everything I need to look at right there built into my goddamn thing, man. I should have had it like that all along. All right. So, yeah, there you go, man. He's saying if this is happening at all, IAEA is going to be standing right there. If it's the Iranians doing the swiping, fine. But sending... And you know what? I mean, boy, I guess he sure will be handing a talking point to the war party if it turns out that this document's authentic and that really is the deal. But he's saying he's never heard of such a thing where they would just say, hey, Mr. Iranian, go into that building and bring me back a swipe. I trust you. That's just not how it works. That is never how it works. The IAEA would never agree to that. And the fact that this says that means that this must be fake. There's no way that's the deal. So if that is the deal, then I guess, you know, boy, Bill Kristol finally told us so about something or something. But I'm going to go ahead and go with Tariq Ralph. I do hope that there's a real fight over whether this is a forgery or not. Forgery! Let's fight! Right? Like, hey, let's... People start accusing each other! Right now! You, sir, are dishonest in your evidence and argument. You know, stuff like that. Get people angry. Get people fighting. Get people in a position where they are forced to prove it for real. George John, go back to your source. Take a picture of the document. Let's see it. We won't settle for anything less because Mr. Ralph, the expert, says couldn't possibly be true. Couldn't be true. And I would, you know, I'm not sure what all happened during the top of the hour news for you guys and what all was made it to the interview or not. But, yeah, he made it clear, very clear in multiple instances of, the language, the way the thing is written and why it doesn't make sense. Especially, of course, what it describes as the process. He debunks all of that. In fact, you know what? You're probably sitting here going, tweet the dang links, Horton. You're right. Let me tweet the links for you here, okay? Here's one, and here is two. It's the second one is the PDF, the debunking PDF. And so he you know, he points out educated guesses and stuff. They call this guy the Deputy Director General for Safeguards, which is almost his correct formal title is the Deputy Director General Head of the Department of Safeguards. And that's what a legit document would say. And then they say, call them the Islamic State up there, but down here they're the Islamic Republic again, and signing for them is Ali Hosseini Tash, Deputy Secretary of Supreme National Security Council for Strategic Affairs. And the comment here is, well, that's not who they deal with in Iran. He's the wrong bureaucrat from the wrong agency to be the signer on here. Reminiscent of the Niger forgeries, indeed. So, there you go, man. Imagine, can you imagine? George John at the AP wrote a thing and then it turned out it wasn't right. You know, in Justin Raimondo's article today, he links to a Google search of antiwar.com and George John. And then there is Jason Ditz debunking George John like 150 times or something. Okay, I'm 100 only. Is over and over and over again. George John publishes something incorrect in the AP by Jason Ditz. Over and over and over and over and over again. Many times debunked by our friend Yosef Butt. I was surprised to hear Tariq Ralph say that George John is somebody with credibility at all. I didn't want to argue with him about that because he was kind of on a roll making a different point at the time. And who can really argue matters of taste? But I think I would argue that John's reporting does not hold up, not now and not ever. Or, I don't know, not ever, but certainly there are enough should be retractions in there that he ought to be, you know, maybe the receptionist at AP, but no longer a journalist for them. Years ago, actually, I made a bumper sticker, 3 or 4 years ago. I made a bumper sticker that said, that Liberty sticker still sells. It says, George John is a liar. Oh, the AP's George John is a liar and probably an Israeli spy. Just thought you should know. That's right. LibertyStickers.com, where you can get bumper stickers about George John and what a lousy reporter he is on the Iran nuclear issue. And you know what? I bet you they sold at least a few. I hope. I sure hope. But anyway. All right. Oh, too late. Yosef Butt just answered me back. Oh, yeah. I have a couple of questions because I asked him, hey, I'm going to interview Ralph. What do you got any questions for? Too late. But all right. The first one he did answer. Yosef Butt's questions were going to be maybe if he has any concern if Iran leads inspections with IAEA looking over their shoulders. He answered that. No, he was not concerned about that. And then should IAEA have done a better job at Al-Kibar? And I didn't really give him a chance to answer that. I brought that up. You know, the mistake in Syria in 2007. And by the way, it was my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna. And yes, I finally learned how to say her middle name. Larissa Alexandrovna. She's the one who debunked in three parts in Raw Story. Well, in two parts, and then the third was Hirsch confirms. But in the first two were all her reported that it was not a nuclear facility that was bombed by Israel in September 2007. It was not a nuclear reactor. That was all just a bunch of crap. You can find that at Raw Story. Just Larissa Syria Raw Story. You'll find it right there in your favorite search engine. And again, in fact, I mentioned it in the interview with him, Yosef's article today, and we'll run it tomorrow on antiwar.com for you. Or maybe we're running it today on antiwar.com because it came out last night, right? Oh, yeah. I had Eric run it today, didn't I? Where the hell is it? Hang on. Where's my antiwar.com link here? Yeah, Yosef Butt. I got it in the viewpoints today on antiwar.com. Understanding IAEA's managed access to Parchin. And in there, I forgot what. Which part of the reporting he accepts or not, but he goes into the story of Syria, what happened in Syria, where everybody was doing it according to the book, where all sides take a sample near the same place at the same time and put them in different bags to go to different labs and all these kinds of things for, you know, science, controlled tests and this kind of stuff. And then, but one guy says, oh, look at me, guys. I got a rogue swipe from the bathroom and put it in my shirt pocket. And lo and behold, that was the one that was found to have uranium on it. Lo and behold, indeed. And how now that has been soundly refuted even by, you know, the professional community types. And Yosef Butt tells the whole story. You can find that article today at antiwar.com. We'll be right back after this. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, man, I can't find the tab anymore. I swear I spent almost this whole break looking for the tab. I had it. Where did it go? I don't even remember what it was called anymore. But it was about the Saudis now are bankrolling a whole new effort. Don't you hate it when you can't find your tab? The Saudis now are bankrolling a whole new multi-million dollar project of TV ads against the Iran deal. Holy crap. You know, I don't know, man. I guess it's looking pretty good for the president. He's got his political party pretty wrapped up in the Congress, I hope. I even saw a thing where maybe they're just, you know, jerking our chain, but I saw a thing where the Republicans may not even be able to overcome cloture because, you know, in the Senate, if the Democrats want to fight about it, they can force the Republicans to come up with 60 votes, not just 51. And so, maybe they won't even be able to pass the disapproval. That would be great. But it's, everybody seems to be saying, yeah, certainly they won't have the votes to override a veto. But Netanyahu was not fooling the Prime Minister of Israel when he said he will do everything he can in his power to ruin this deal, to stop this deal. And that's despite the fact that, as you can read regularly nowadays in the Jewish Daily Forward, J.J. Goldberg's articles there, I believe he is the editor, senior editor, whatever, there, that the Israeli national security state is for the deal. Only the politicians are not, for political reasons. But they even had an official report, IDF intelligence. So they're DIA, basically, right? Military intelligence estimates nuclear deal could include incentives to Iran to not attack Western targets. So as Goldberg puts it, he says, well, whatever, you can read it yourself, but it's the game-changing Iran report that Bibi fears. Bibi is Benjamin Netanyahu's nickname. Can't we just call him Netanyahu for short? We got to respect the fact that he has some cutesy little nickname that we're supposed to call him. I don't think so. Anyway, Netanyahu, how about PM? There's this report that's come up from military intelligence that's a list of pros and cons, which, you know, basically is hurting because Netanyahu's orders to the entire government is to pretend that this is just the end of the world, only cons, and only a madman would support it and all this kind of thing. That's the narrative they're pushing. And yet, J.J. Goldberg just destroys Netanyahu's narrative here in this article, explaining how there are scores of Israeli generals and intelligence officials who are supporting the deal, or at least say, you know, it's not nearly as bad as he thinks, and our relationship with America is more important in the long term, so he shouldn't be challenging the Americans this hard, which actually that's the silver lining, if you ask me. As Americans get to see just how anti-American the Prime Minister of Israel is when it comes down to it. He thinks, you know, that's the story of even Bill Clinton, who is despicable in every way. I'm not saying that, but the story of the first time Bill Clinton ever met Benjamin Netanyahu was, you know, who does this effing guy think he is? What in the world? I'm the emperor, and he's the governor of Maryland, and he's talking to me like I'm his employee, you know? I'm paraphrasing a bit, but that's, you know, the relative real power of America versus Israel. And yet, who Netanyahu thinks he is compared to the measly president of the United States? Bill Clinton's his butler. Bill Clinton's nothing. You know, I'll tell you, here's what you're going to do for me, Bill. You know, this kind of thing. Forgot how much I, or how I got on that tangent of, just what a despicable person that guy is. But anyway, he's blowing it. And the national security state over there in Israel is supporting the deal at this point and making a fool out of him. But then again, he's got a lot of power and influence and money. And in Washington, D.C., those congressmen and senators, they don't care about what's right and true. They care about what's going to get them reelected. And the Israel lobby is trying to make them believe that, hey, Obama's going to be gone, but we're still going to be here. On the other hand, I think Obama's reminding them that, hey, you got midterms coming up. You're going to be the one who betrayed me on the Iran deal right before, or not even midterms. You got the full terms. You got the, you got your own reelection, especially House members. You've got your own reelection to worry about. You're going to be the guy that betrayed your Democratic president on the peace deal. You might not make it to, you know, the next elections for the Israel lobby to screw you. So that's the only thing that they care about. That's the only thing they're balancing. You know, the president's power within the Democratic Party and you know, versus Israel's. So, I don't know, man. Place your bets, everybody. I'm happy to say I think they're going to do it. You know, I think Obama's coming out ahead, but it's not a done deal yet. Certainly should be, but it's not a done deal yet. And, you know, the narratives that, you know, TV creates that can be really powerful. I was talking with Eric Garris about how, you know, I mostly watch Fox because I want it straight from the Pentagon. Just go ahead and lie to me, man. Give me the worst you got. But Eric was saying, you know, no, man, CNN is worse than Fox on the Iran nuclear deal. Now, no matter what happens on the Iran nuclear deal, they interview, you know, as soon as they report the news, their expert guest in studio is always against it. Always. And, of course, the reporters know nothing about it, the anchors. And so they can't say, wait a minute now, that's not really right, though, because what about this? There's no pushback, no follow-up for all the bogus excuses of the Iran deal's opponents. And they're pushing that narrative. It's working well, man. Consensus is a powerful thing, you know? It's just like that story about the emperor wears no clothes, you know? That's why it's such a, you know, a story that people still tell after all these years or whatever. It's because that's how grown-ups are, man. They will sit there and lie and go, oh, yeah, me? I totally know about what's going on here. Yeah, they're totally selling out to Iran, giving them the bomb and path to the bomb. And they don't ever talk about the actual details. They don't ever say what the deal says. You know, actually, they just characterize it. And it works. It works, man. I hear tell from regular people, man. All the time. And, you know, I mean, I guess it's just my, obviously I'm very well versed on this particular issue, but my bias is, look, if they're telling you why to oppose a peace deal, then at least be skeptical, right? At least start with your bias against them. Maybe they can convince you, but they're telling you why somebody's got to be bombed or why a deal to preclude bombing must be stopped. I think you could at least err on the side of peace after all this now, no?
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's the thing here, man. All right. Let's see here. Yeah, no, I should have done this during the break. I'm going to talk about Israel and Palestine here for a minute, and then Yemen in the next segment. How about that? So check this out. There's a guy named Bradley Burstyn, and I admit I don't know a lot about him, but I've read a lot about him, so I do know a lot about him. Apparently, he's been writing for Haaretz, which is the liberal, it's the New York Times of Israel. It's the liberal daily in Tel Aviv. And it's, you know, mostly mainstream. They do feature Amir Ahas and a couple other harsh critics of Israeli policy, but not mostly. And this guy has been characterized by people who are familiar with him as a longtime apologist for Israeli policy. So this is not just another essay at Haaretz. This is one of their highest level editors who's had a major change of heart and written this piece. It's time to admit it. Israeli policy is what it is. Apartheid. I used to be one of those people who took issue with the label of apartheid as applied to Israel. Not anymore. Oh, that's not that long. Here it go. I used to be one of those people who took issue with the label of apartheid as applied to Israel. I was one of those people who could be counted on to argue that while the country's settlement and occupation policies were anti-democratic and brutal and slow-dose suicidal, the word apartheid did not apply. I'm not one of those people anymore. Not after the last few weeks. Not after terrorists firebombed a West Bank Palestinian home, annihilating a family, murdering an 18-month-old boy and his father, burning his mother over 90% of her body, only to have Israel's government rule the family ineligible for the financial support and compensation automatically granted to Israeli victims of terrorism, settlers included. I can't pretend anymore. Not after Israel's Justice Minister, Eilat Shaked, explicitly declared stone-throwing to be terrorism, drove the passage of a bill holding stone-throwers liable to up to 20 years in prison. The law did not specify that it targeted only Palestinian stone-throwers. It didn't have to. Just 1 week later, pro-settlement Jews hurled rocks, furniture, and bottles of urine at Israeli soldiers and police at a West Bank settlement, and in response, Benjamin Netanyahu immediately rewarded the Jewish stone throwers with a pledge to build hundreds of new settlement homes. This is what has become of the rule of law. Two sets of books, one for us and one to throw at them. Apartheid. We are what we have created. We are what we do. And the injury we do in a thousand ways to millions of others. We are what we turn a blind eye to. Our Israel is what it has become. Apartheid. And he goes on. So there you go. That's it. That's what happens when an honest man just looks and goes, whoa, man. You know, this isn't working out. And, you know, I really don't have a dog in the fight or carry the way, honestly. But I think I disagree with Max Blumenthal and other liberal former Zionists that I know of who argue that this is just part and parcel of Zionism at all. That the problem is not 67 borders, but 48 borders. I mean, I agree with that, basically. But, you know, the argument is made that it couldn't be any other way. And that's the part where I really disagree. And I guess mostly because of this essay I read one time by M.J. Rosenberg, and I talked with him about it. This would have been years ago now. I don't remember what it was called.
In fact, he always had a hard time finding it when I asked him about it. But it was something that MJ Rosenberg had written where he goes way back to, say, 67. Maybe this doesn't prove his point, but the opposite. But I don't know. He goes back to at least 67, maybe before then. And he says, the peacenik, the Israeli peaceniks said this. And the war party said this. And then the war party did what they wanted. And then it turned out that the peaceniks were right. And then he cites that same dynamic over and over and over and over and over and over again, where there were Israelis who said, no, don't do this. This is what's going to be the obvious bad result if you do. And then that's what happened. And now I got to admit, I shouldn't have cited Max there because I never finished Goliath. I just couldn't stand it. I mean, it's a great book, but I just couldn't stand reading about this crap anymore. But I know that he does in that book. He talks about this guy Leibowitz, who was a rabbi who warned against the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I don't think you have to endorse the Nakba to say that at least technically, amorally, it makes sense that once you have kicked all the Arabs out, they've been kicked out, it's your country now, that kind of thing. But what's happened in the West Bank is, and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, is they've conquered it, but all the people are still there. Living as, you know, 100th class citizens with no rights whatsoever under foreign occupation all this time. And what Leibowitz warned back then was this is going to change, of course, the nature of the country of Israel, not just the nature of the state, but the nature of the country, the land and the people, and what they're about. And what they're about is occupying people for half a century in a row now in this brutal occupation and colonization of their property and territory. And it's changed Israel. And when I first started talking with Max Blumenthal about Israel back, say, I don't know, 7 years, 8 years, whatever ago, it was when he was first researching the book Goliath, and he was basically reporting back that this country is way too far gone. We're talking like a whole country voting for Trump right now. We're talking a whole country that is to the right of the American Tea Party. The whole damn political class is so far gone, just forget it. Two-state solution? Independence for Palestine? Under these guys? And not just pointing the finger at the politicians, but at the larger society. Nuh-uh. With this population as your voters, there will not be peace. Too late. You know, maybe if somebody could have stopped the Netanyahu fanatic from assassinating Yitzhak Rabin back in 95, maybe then. But too late now. And I don't know, you know, exactly when too late was. I guess what I was trying to get at was I think Max says it was always too late. And that's what Phil Weiss says, too. Phil Weiss has said on the show that it was always destined to be this way, greater Israel at the expense of their neighbors forever. Peace with their neighbors. And just think, I mean, to me, the counterfactual is so obvious. What if Israel just lived within their 67 borders, they shared Jerusalem, they gave up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to be an independent Palestinian state, and they just tried to get along with their neighbors in more or less peace and harmony for the next few hundred years into, you know, too far into the future for us to imagine. Doesn't that make more sense? I mean, they've had Egypt and Jordan on a leash for a generation now. There's no problem there. They never really had a problem with Assad other than he backs Hezbollah, which keeps him from stealing the Litani River, but is no offensive threat. They could have peace. They could act right and get along, don't you think? Maybe not. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition.
15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom. FFF.org/subscribe. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Can you believe it's already almost over, man? That's all right. I'm going to talk to you about something important here, and that's the war on Yemen. The spotlight today on antiwar.com is by Sonali Kolhatkar. Kolhatkar? I tried to get her on the show. It did not work. Maybe I'll talk with her next week or something. But I like the title. The title is, Why Are We Ignoring the War on Yemen? And yes, she's defining we broadly. But she's right. That's not just the mainstream media, but the alternative media too. Everybody's falling down on the job. And I admit it too. Yemen ought to be the top story every day on this show. And it's really hard to find anybody doing any good writing about it. And actually, that's not true. I just haven't done good enough work finding people who are writing about it. And you know, part of the problem is I have very specific questions I'm trying to ask. Like, I've been trying to get a hold of these LA Times reporters because they're talking about the American role there. And that's what I want to know the most detail about. But I did talk with the guy from Oxfam about the famine going on. America, you're doing wrong, man. I don't know how people can still be on Team USA government here. These people are the cruelest monsters on this planet. And, you know, I've heard it said that, oh, the Saudis, they're not listening to the Americans anymore. The new guy, Crown Prince, whatever his name is, Hussein Mohammed, something. Yeah, he's just doing whatever he wants. That is such a lie. Who among you believes the Saudis are running their own air traffic control over Yemen right now? Right, I didn't believe it either. I don't believe that for a moment. And they've admitted that they're helping them pick targets. Yeah. Oh, but not guiding them to the targets and home again, huh? Oh, yeah, no, they're meeting them in midair and providing them with midair refueling from our tankers. That's admitted. I don't think it's much of a hop, skip, and a jump from here to the U.S. owns this entire freaking war. And that if Obama told the Saudis, we're done. No more U.S. Navy, no more U.S. Air Force coordinating this war for you. No more American spies or, you know, military officers picking targets for you. We're done. You're done. It'd be over. And it shouldn't even have to come to an ultimatum whatsoever. Why would it come to an ultimatum? That's accepting the argument for the sake of argument that the new crown prince, you know, refuses to take good advice from his betters. Tell him, yeah, but we really mean it. And in fact, watch, we're not going to help you anymore. You know, that's pretty good way to enforce your will there, when. So what's happening? I try to tell you as fast as I can in a way that you could, like, get it once, even if you don't know nothing. Southeast corner of the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen, right? The dictator there, Saleh, worked for America for 30 years, up until just as bin Laden planned American intervention all throughout the Middle East, destabilized everything, and set off the Arab Spring in Tunisia, and then Egypt, and then everywhere else, to one degree or another. And in Yemen, all factions came together. The Sunni Muslim believers, the socialists, who I assume are, you know, atheist Marxist types, mostly, and the significant parts of the army, as well as the Houthi rebels, who are Zaydi Shia, who live in the north. And America had been paying Saleh to fight the war on terror against Al-Qaeda and let America fly drones and kill people with our drones, the CIA and the DOD over there, for years and years. It's all in the WikiLeaks of Saleh agreeing to take the blame or the credit for whenever American killed civilians over there, which was a lot. You know, tiny little helpless babies and people like that, their moms. And
So what happened, though, was Saleh spent all the money and all the counterterrorism training, not fighting al-Qaeda, but fighting the Houthis, who were his problem. Well, all he ended up doing was losing to them over and over again, and they ended up getting more and more powerful and gaining more and more ground every time that they whooped him. So then by the time of 2011 and the Arab Spring, boy, I said I was going to say this fast so you could get it. By the time the people of Yemen all rose up and overthrew his sorry ass and put him out, the Americans decided that they were going, well, the Houthis were, you know, independent, autonomous up there in the north. And the Americans decided that what they would try to do in Egypt, they would get away with it in Yemen. And that is go ahead and get rid of the current figurehead and replace him with the next mustache in line, as Greg Palast might say, and then carry on. They didn't get away with that in Egypt. They had to wait a year and a half and then do a coup d'etat. But anyway, in Yemen, they put in the vice president, Hadi. And Hillary called it a democratic election, except there was just one name on the ballot, his. And it was no election at all, but it was enough to basically defuse the Arab Spring for then, you know, for that time. But the problem is he had no support. The people, I guess, you know, didn't overthrow him, but he had no support. So then the Houthis came to town, and guess who was their ally? Saleh, the former dictator, who wants his power and influence back and still had major parts of the army loyal to him, who made a deal with his old enemies, the Houthis. He actually is a Zaydi, but not a Houthi. Houthi is a political movement. Zaydi is the kind of Shia that they are. So he had enough in common with them and made common cause then with the Houthis. And they marched on Sana'a, the capital, drove Hadi out. And in fact, they went all the way to the port city of Aden and drove him to Saudi Arabia. And at that point, you know, where he fled to Saudi Arabia, at that point, Saudi started bombing. And with, I think, Morocco and Egypt and Kuwait and UAE and Qatar and everybody joining in, sending planes to bomb him. And it was in the Wall Street Journal about 6 weeks ago now, I guess. Let me get the article for you so I can prove it. Oh, in the meantime, here's Jason Ditz. U.S. confirms Saudi's using cluster bombs on the people of Yemen here. That's at news.antiwar.com. So Wall Street Journal, Yemen, and then that's probably all I need right there to get the U.S. widens role in Saudi-led campaign. I don't think that's the one. Yeah, from April. That's it. April 12th. And so now America's still killing al-Qaeda guys with drones, or trying to. They're killing somebody in the name of killing al-Qaeda with drones over there. But at the same time, they're coordinating Saudi's war against the Houthis, who, guess what, are al-Qaeda's biggest enemies on the ground there. They're literally, you know, I like to joke about how we're fighting for Iran and against the jihad, the Sunni jihadists in Iraq, but against Iran and for the Sunni jihadists in Syria. Here in Yemen, we're fighting for both at the same time. Not even switching back and forth. Simultaneous. Like Reagan backing both sides of the Iran-Iraq war back in his days in the 1980s. Here, Saddam, use this poison gas and coordinates to attack the Iranians. Here, Ayatollah, here's some anti-tank missiles. There you go. America's fighting for and against al-Qaeda right now. We're bombing al-Qaeda's enemies while we're bombing al-Qaeda. And why won't Obama call it off? When, to get to the heart of this thing, as Sonali Kolhatkar points out today at truthdig.com, again, it's the spotlight at antiwar.com, every humanitarian organization on the planet is screaming their head off right now. UNICEF and HRW and Amnesty and the International Committee of the Red Cross, Doctors Without Borders, are saying, for God's sake, man, make a ceasefire. Let us in there. People are dying. And see, here's the thing, man. And Patrick Coburn told us 8, 10, 12 weeks ago, more, he said on this show, they import 90% of their food. 90% of their food. There's a blockade on. What does that mean? That means they're laying down to die is what that means. That means Obama, just like he did in Somalia in 2011, is forcing a famine on the weakest poorest country in the Middle East. I told you so too, man. You know, he told you so too. Remember, after David Petraeus held him down and Stanley McChrystal punked him in November of 2009, and Obama gave his big Afghan surge speech, at the end of the speech, he said, Somalia, Yemen, you're next. Yeah, they sure as hell are. And you knew at the time, right, that he meant the women and children. I'm going to starve you to death, babies. That was what he was saying. That was what he meant.